Muller House meeting, Monday morning, 27th of September, 1976. On this morning of magical beauty around us, let us consider right happiness. We all know that in the ordinary way, the pleasure drive is one of the most powerful sources of the ill state of mind and body. Because the pleasure drive is in actual fact a dual drive. It is a pleasure-pain drive. After pleasure, there is a sense of ennui, a sense of something lost, something over. There's a depression. There is always the memory of pleasure which comes up. And if it is not obtainable, well, then there is resentment. So there is pain associated with it. Pleasure, desired, planned pleasure, frustrated, also causes pain. And pain, of course, is painful, directly. So that the pleasure-pain drive as such in itself is one of the powerful sources of our state of ill-ease within ourselves. But our psychophysical existence definitely needs happiness for its good health. And we must try to understand what is the nature of this true happiness and what sort of experiencing of happiness has no ill consequence afterwards. It is now known scientifically there are what are called the pleasure areas in the brain. And if they don't receive their proper sustenance, the whole organism begins to suffer, to be ill. Physically, psychologically. Now, what is right pleasure? In a few words, it is that pleasure which we experience when it comes naturally and spontaneously to us, without being sought by us. We are happy through observing, fully experiencing what is actually present. That is the mechanism of the process. And there is the more important aspect that the psyche must not grasp at that pleasure and want to store it as a memory or as something to be repeated. And this is the most difficult and the worst part of the situation. We remember pleasurable circumstances, pleasurable experiences, And then craving grows for them. We want to grasp them again and again. We want them repeated again and again. We become insatiable. We become the slaves of pleasure. And that's where pleasure harms both body and psyche. So, if we are intelligent, truly intelligent, we experience the immediate present and do not try to hold it back and store it up for future use. Because what we are trying to store is a dead fossil, belongs to the past. Whereas the actual experiencing now is the living present, which is the source of true happiness, the living happiness now. We can't subsist upon the happiness which is dead. We can subsist only upon the happiness which is now. This happiness is essential for not only our own well-being, but for the well-being of all others around us and with those in whom we come in contact. If I am feeling a bit depressed or worried about something, and a truly happy person, quiet and radiating happiness, comes along, inside a minute I've quite forgotten all my misery, and I'm happy too. We have all experienced that. We all know what it is like. And that is right happiness, right pleasure, which is necessary for healthy existence, psychophysically. Now, the factor which becomes more strongly pronounced in this connection, where living the religious life is concerned, living in communion is concerned, is that we have to learn to use all our senses fully. The right and full use of the senses means that none of the senses are misused. Consider this carefully by yourselves in the quiet. To use all our senses rightly and to the fullest extent without misusing our senses. One can easily give common a garden everyday examples. Our sense of taste, how we gratify it with food and drink, how we become greedy, we become the slaves of our desires to eat and drink and all that sort of thing. Not that we mustn't eat and drink, obviously, but just consider how human beings do act in this matter. How we overeat, eat the wrong things, which produce illness, and so forth. That's just one example. Take the sense of touch, how we indulge our sense of touch in so many ways, and look at the extraordinarily troublesome situations into which such indulgence leads us. Situations which touch, which concern our morality, our human relationships, and so many other things. How out of one little misuse of a sense, such a mountain of mischief comes into being. So you see, the right use and the full use of our senses, and no misuse of the senses. This is where a practice like our meditative walking, in which the senses are rightly used, plays a very important part. And one word about this meditative walking. Whilst we are walking, we see, we hear, we touch, we smell, and so on. But when we are looking at something, let us not look at it as merely a separate object. That will save us from all unnecessary analytical looking. There is that tree. Look at all its leaves. They've got an autumn tint and this, that and the other, and the brain goes talking away merrily. If we look at it meditatively, we will be aware of all the color and the shape and the beauty and the movement and so on. But we do not allow that to captivate our attention. If we look at it meditatively, we are looking at it with the whole spirit of communion, of unification, fully in play. Then one actually experiences the deep meaning of being at one with the tree, at one with the forest, the meadow, the cattle, the whatever it is. And that sense of at oneness, without any analysis, without any conditions whatsoever, is one of the simplest ways of awakening the sense of transcendence in us. Because what is an at-one-ment, an atonement? It is a freeing ourselves from the limitation of isolative self-consciousness, so that we are aware, not just in terms of I, John Brown, am looking at that mountain or whatever it is, but there is a looking taking place. And in that sort of looking, it is not merely I, John Brown, who am looking, but the whole world, pure mind itself, transcendence, if you like, is looking through my eyes at the same time. And whilst I, the ordinary mortal, look with all my conditioning and my preconceptions and so forth, and therefore do not see wholly and completely, when transcendence sees through your eyes, you as well as transcendence see the totality. And in that seeing of the totality, you experience all the deep, profound archetypal forces which work throughout the universe. You know spiritual reality for the first time in the true sense. Because now, pure mind, unconditioned, the universal mind, is functioning directly through your senses. And we ourselves, that way, experience pure happiness. The happiness which we never grasp. We never want to grasp it. We wouldn't dare to want to grasp it, because that would be sacrilege. It would be a touch of evil upon what is transcendentally good, the absolute good. These are the ways one comes to realize, make or real. What we have named as goodness and beauty and truth and love and benediction and all these other things, they become real because the total reality of the universe is functioning through each one of us without any hindrance from us. So the reality remains utterly pure. Then there is no conflict of good and evil inside us. Everything becomes the perfect good, the unbroken holiness. And it really is an extraordinary thing to experience, even if for a few moments now and again. But once you experience something like this, for the rest of your life, the hound of heaven keeps you safely within the bounds of heaven. And the bounds of heaven are the universal totality. Large enough space for a little person like myself. That is how it is. What a happiness that is. With no ill consequence anywhere. No bondage anywhere. Utter freedom. Utter purity. Utter loveliness. And this is what it means to be a human being. And this is the kind of communion we can realize here and now at our psychophysical level with the actual, what we call, material universe. And when we experience it that way, our illusion that the material is different from or opposed to the mental in the sense of pure mind, or the spiritual in the sense of transcendence, all that illusion of difference or opposition between them vanishes. And you really understand the one total reality. Because you understand, therefore, that transcendent creative power awakens to self-knowledge within itself. What a responsibility is man's, the human, the blissful creator. One awakens to that from within. When you see the external conflicts of the world, they go on because one is involved with the world in one's everyday life. They go on, but somehow you are left utterly untouched by them. Unspotted, unbesmirched. You are left utterly pure by all the dirt through which you move. Extraordinary thing. And if we understand this and can experience it even in a little way in our ordinary life, then some of the very profound truths which have been expressed in words which baffle our intellects, those truths become clear as the sun shining in the mid-heavens, unclouded. Statements like the ever-virgin mother, immaculate conception. See, these are tremendous things and they have tremendous power because they represent, those words represent the actual creative process throughout the universe of this unknown and unknowable by the brain creative power, which is everlastingly at work in space and time, through space and time, and beyond space and time. That is why I have called it creative action in eternity. It is creative action in eternity which throws out mind in its transcendence and all the great archetypal powers and forces invisible to us, unbeknown to the bulk of humanity, but which you and I can awaken to. See, one of the meanings of the mercy, the compassion, the infinite benevolence, as Zarathustra put it in the Gathas, the bountifulness of the Lord. This is the bounty poured out all the time throughout this mighty universe. And that bounty has included granting us this extraordinary faculty which the stones and the trees don't have, of choice. We can say nay to the Almighty, to this infinitely powerful creative energy. We can say nay to it. But because we have this power, because we misuse it and get hurt and suffer, therefore, that is the stimulus to wake us up. We rise up in passion. What is the meaning of it all? Why should this happen? Etc., etc. And if we really care to learn, to discover, this is the fulfillment, the fruition, the end of the road, which is just here and now where we start. Just here and now. This will be our last morning together. But throughout your days, you can practice this. There are opportunities always. And when you practice, don't try to remember what you experienced on such and such a day at Elmau, how wonderful it was. But the London streets are murky and noisy and so forth. Don't let it be like that. This is how it is. See the actual fact of it. Do not reject it. Do not cling to it. Reject it if it is unpleasant in terms of physical sensation, or cling to it because it is pleasant in terms of physical sensation. This is our mistake. And this is the mistake that we can learn to become free of through our practice in this beautiful, wonderful place, for which we can never be too grateful to those who organize and enable us to have the opportunity to experience such wonderful beauty. Experiencing this, that subtler communion with mind, within the inner deeps of mind, with transcendence itself in its own nature, can be realized and experienced by you, by me. You have statements about this throughout the scriptures. Zarathustra says, when, O Ahuramazda, I beheld thee in my mind. How do you behold God? In your mind. As a gentleman with a long white beard and a piercing glance or anything? Not at all. But those words of ordinary familiar language hide this transcendent reality. And there are no words to put the transcendent reality exactly as it is. You can't do it. So he uses words like that. In the Bible, and Moses beheld the Lord face to face and spoke with him, And when he came down from the mountain, his countenance shone with light. What mountain? There was no physical mountain up which he went, whether Sinai or Horeb or any such thing. This is the mount within our own selves, in the supreme realms of communion possible. That is what the mount stands for. The Zarathustrians have Mount Ushidarena, the Hindus have Mount Meru, and so on. All the religions have their own particular expressions of it. The Buddha's appearance becomes transfigured, and Ananda, the beloved disciple, beholds it. Jesus becomes transfigured, and those three disciples behold it. So these are some of the ways we can understand all these teachings. But if we do understand, there is this inexhaustible fount of happiness, of true happiness and beauty. And the key point to remember is not to grasp, not to experience through the senses as a separate being. I, the separate being, experiencing, seeing, hearing, touching, tasting that, but meditatively, with the feeling of communion. Just let that feeling of communion be there, and don't put anything into your money box, so to say, store it up for future use. There is no future, there is the now, the living now. The future is my illusion. Let's go out now. When we look at shapes, colors, curves, lines, angles, and so on, in nature or anywhere, let us not just think of them as curves or flat surfaces or anything like that. The intellectualizing of what is conveyed through the senses. See, all curves and shapes and colors have a great message. They are all the time speaking to us in their language. Now, this is something quite lost to us, especially in our modern age, which has become so concerned and so over-occupied with dealing with material things and bending material things to our will, that we miss that message all the time. There are certain aspects where the message cannot be missed. The sheer beauty of the particular shape and so forth draws us, and we derive something from it, as we say. But that drawing is a power of releasing the state of communion. That is one example of it. The commonest example in the organic, in the living world of creatures, is that the shape and the shape of the body is a source of natural attraction between man and woman. The color, the gait, the voice, everything, isn't that so? It tells something without the brain ever bothering to translate it into speech. So that which is greater than, well, greater in the sense of being able to be less confined than speech, is at play. We call these sort of natural attractions between people. Afterwards we may say, oh, I love his strong shoulders, or I was captivated by the color of her eyes, or... Poets have written about this
ad infinitum. So there we are, we know about it. But there is a very much profounder aspect. All manifestation is in terms of color, shape, sound, curves, lines, space-time at work on their own. Why do you think in the old days they talked of subjects like geometry as one of the sacred sciences? What is there about geometry to call it a sacred science? When we learn geometry at school, we never think of it as a sacred science. Some of us think of it as an awful nuisance and a bore because we couldn't do it. But why is it a sacred science? See, manifestation is the concrete expression of measurement. In the Rig Veda, you read some of the hymns to the different gods, as they are called. Varuna, Agni, Indra, Soma. And they write, he measured out the spaces and laid the foundations. You know, just like in the Bible, you find the same sort of phraseology cropping up here and there. Obviously, this is just anthropomorphic expression. He measured out. There is no God as a figure measuring out spaces, you see, and so forth. But it refers to the extraordinary inward effect upon our minds. Our brains are extremely complex organisms. We know simple things like this, that the brain has 10 or 15,000 million cells and so forth. And we say 10 or 15,000 million cells and it means nothing to us. Those who have researched on the brain have found out here is the center which records sight and hearing and so forth. But the right side of the brain is still a very great mystery. Only recently they are waking up to the fact that in some way or other it is concerned with the deeper functions of the human mind. We are just beginning to wake up to that. Now the old people in some way knew it. So they said, the spiritual heart is on the right side of the body. The material heart is on the left side of the body. They didn't say any more. Now, putting it that way, the wrong people never got hold of the right idea. Because, you know, a wrong person gets hold of a power and he immediately misuses it. Immediately, inevitably, always misuses it. You see, till he gets sufficiently hurt and stops misusing it. And only afterwards he begins to use it rightly. If then. See? The word hridaya, heart, means not only this heart, you see, but heart in the emotional sense, and in its widest sense it means the very center, essence, core of anything and everything. Now, our deeper mental and spiritual functioning is associated with the right side of the brain, and that's sort of slowly coming to light. Shape, line, color, the geometry of the world in which we live, if you like. You see, I'm giving only one example. All this has this influence upon the living person all the time. And nature is in no hurry. Nature has brought us to this state after 3-4 million years, goodness knows how many. And nature says, well, I've got a little bit of time left to make a good job of man, you see. And she's very, very slow. Nature knows very well indeed the significance of the ripeness of the circumstance. We don't. We are always in a hurry, always we want, oh, I want this, mummy, at once. We are like that. And not nice children at that very often. Really naughty children all the time. Nature says, all right, you fall down and hurt yourself, then you might begin to learn. And nature doesn't care. That's a fact. Nature doesn't care. She can't. She's got too much business to bother about foolish creatures like naughty humans. You see? This has to be borne. But these powers and influences are always active. And if one learns to be in communion with nature, not just using the senses to observe her externally, but to be at one with her, all kinds of subtle learning processes beyond thought and word take place. And the evolution and growth of the whole man, physical, psychical, spiritual, they all take place simultaneously. And this gradual purification and perfection by which the psychophysical organism no longer offers any obstruction to mind in its universal, in its universality, and in its infinite plenitude, can function freely through all the senses. These are deep things which now all the world is slowly waking up to. It isn't a prerogative of any one race or culture. It is with all of us. So when you see these things, don't see it merely as a curve or a circle. But meditatively, you be one with the curve, and all sorts of wonderful things happen inside. Let's go on. The change that constantly goes on. It isn't static. You see how all the time there is change taking place. Activity. Nature's dance, nature's joy of life. It is the joy that is beyond all sorrow. And as we experience this joy, it also heals the unnecessary sorrow we have heaped up inside our own psyche. The psyche is like a container, a box. And deep down in the depths, we tend to press down what we don't like and what has hurt us. That is why when we are foolish enough to take a wrong step of the same sort 10 or 15 years later, the whole thing hurts far more than ever before. And this comes out most strongly in the man-woman relationship. Look at our wonderful film stars who make a 7th or a 77th marriage or whatever it is, chasing happiness. And what do they find? Another fool to deal with. Well, that, any wonder they said, I will lift up mine eyes unto the hills, whence cometh my help. Hey, with every step we take, there's a new shape. There is a new beauty all the time. That means that the whole of nature is giving us a new message as we move through it. And it is this newness which is the important thing. There is nothing stale in the universe, which is a living universe, perpetually changing. But changing not in the sense of something you can't rely upon. Fickle. It's not fickle. It is creatively playing with us for our delight, just as it takes delight from us by our delight. You see, talk about the love of nature or something. The extraordinary things that that means. The infinite complexity of it, and at the same time, the extraordinary simplicity of the whole thing. And if we are truly attentive, as we look, as we listen, all these things come to life inside us and activate perhaps the right side of the brain through which we contact transcendental energies at their level. You know, in the Samapattis, in the Buddhist teaching, after the four jhanas, the four Samapattis are mentioned. In the Upanishads, you get the states of Sushupti and Turiya mentioned, you see. They all sort of suggest this kind of thing. If one doesn't merely read the printed word or merely think about it, stirring up the well, the small well of pond, I shall say, the small stagnant pond of thought, then all this comes to life in us. Nature is mother. God is father. We can talk like this. The mother nurtures us. And we learn our lessons on our mother's knees, not on father's knees. Sometimes something else happens on father's knees. Notice with each step how new heights emerge, new magnificences. What does that sort of thing evoke in the worldling, the man of the world, subject to his ambitions and passion to achieve and conquer and so forth? The absurd answers they give. Why did you want to climb Everest? Because it is there. Even a child would have more sense than that. But you see, what a lesson. The viewing, which is unambitious, untainted by ambition, it's a wonderful thing. So it is not oneself who climbs to higher heights. An ego blowing up his own egoism. When you walk meditatively, there is something utterly different which happens inside one's own psyche. It's an extraordinary purification of the psyche. Now, if one can take this into oneself, or rather, let me put it in a better way, if I can allow this to flow into ourselves completely and flow out without let or hindrance, we also develop the power to let what is physically unpleasant in the way of sensation and condition and situation and so forth We can let all that come into ourselves. And so the psyche becomes more and more absorptive. And it becomes absorptive in an extraordinary way. Not possessively. Not with the desire to make a difference to the situation. Because it has grown to know that if it is completely quiet, this immense transcendent energy does all the work of purification, changing it in the right way and in the ripeness of circumstance. That doesn't mean that we should just sit down and do nothing about the situation. Not at all. When we really see the situation meditatively, it is always accompanied by the right physical action as and where necessary. Most people perform action unnecessarily. They are interferers, not only with the ordinary process of life, but with these transcendent energies of mind and the great archetypal energies that function throughout the world, throughout the universe, from working in their own way. And so man heaps trouble upon trouble on his own head. And it's so simple. Just stay at home, be quiet. At home meaning here, inside oneself. Quiet. And when this and that are quiet and not in turmoil, the Lord comes in and says, aha, here's a nice place for me. I can live happily here. This kind of meditative moving of the body and the using of the senses is one of the actual states of meditation in the profoundest sense. In the profoundest sense, meditation means, use the original word samadhi, the complete togetherness. The complete togetherness, you see, and in this is healing and fulfillment, not just for oneself, but healing and fulfillment everywhere. This is something we don't know, and this is also one of the deep meanings of prayer. You look at study. For instance, either the Sufi or the Christian mystics, their touch with nature. In the life of Christ himself, for instance, he and his disciples go to the Mount of Olives and spend the night in prayer. Do you think they were just mumbling a whole set of words throughout the night? They were in meditation, in the quiet of the night, in the stillness of the night, in that darkness which holds the potentiality of all light and all illumination within itself. In that stillness of the night, the great mystery gets enacted constantly, without the brain of man interfering with that mystery. It is these things which will bring the human race to ultimate fulfillment. Nothing that we plan and think and do. What we plan and think and do is mainly to teach us what not to do, which is also necessary. We ordinarily think those tiles and that wood is dead. But just breathe quietly as you look at it, rhythmically. When we breathe rhythmically, we are breathing in tune with the pulse of life itself. Our own particular rhythm, our own particular note is sounding in this whole symphony of life. And it's a magical thing. Just let the breath flow in quietly by itself. Don't be too consciously attentive to it. And just look at what we commonly call dead stuff. Does it not feel as if it is suddenly sheltering us? Although we are outside it, as we say, and yet we are inside it. Because there is the state of communion. If one can meditatively feel the autumn, one of the things that happens within oneself is that one becomes free of the passion to hold on to life, to continue to live. One is with the autumn. So one is not dying in the sense of being destroyed or annihilated, but in the sense of being cyclically transformed into fresh life. So that the mind and the heart, free of clinging, when actual death is coming, the death of the organism itself, the mind and the heart are in perfect calm, and they know that final ecstasy of death, which is the supreme gift of transcendence of the creative energy to all finite, limited, particular, mortal, separate manifestations. Then one knows, one sees inwardly that the Lord of Death holds the secret of life in his hands. And whoso doesn't resist death is more in tune with life than he who concentrates on life. Happiness, joy, and the peace that passes all understanding . See why the Buddha said, and this is deathlessness, the complete cessation, the complete freedom from all grasping. This is the meaning, or at least one of the meanings. The beauty and the glory of the maturing, the autumn, and then the magnificence and marvel and the mellowness of sunset, the colors in the sky. And finally the sun sinks beyond the horizon, or appears to sink beyond the horizon. How beautiful death is, how wonderful death is. But we don't understand it, therefore we don't love it, we fear it. And because of that fear, we prevent our full growth. We try to hold it back to the condition that we know. Extraordinarily fortunate this time, these 4 days. We've had wonderful 4 days for this sort of meditative walking. That's about probably fill that. What meaning it hides. Can you hear those cowbells? Or sheep? Sheep? Yes, they are sheep. Yes. Perhaps the most difficult communication is between oneself and other human beings. It's easy enough, comparatively, to see and hear and touch meditatively where nature is concerned, where beauty is concerned. But the moment there is a human being present, there is a tension, there is a difficulty. But if we grow in the power of meditative communication, then that difficulty in relation to human beings also disappears. Mainly because the selfness, the isolating self-consciousness, I, is out of the picture. And there is only you. Then it is as wonderful as anything else in nature.